Hooray! It's the Brawl in the Family podcast, why not? Or, as they might say in Star Fox...
Brawl in the Family podcast!
Podcast episode 3, Earthbound and Timelessness.
Please excuse the background, because I kind of messed up and left the sound file at the other place, so I just had to improvise, so you're just going to have to deal with it.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to the long overdue third episode of the Brawl in the Family podcast. I'm your host Matthew, and here is Chris.
Hi, how's it going everybody?
Yep, and we're back to regale you once again with our discussion of various games, and of course things going on in the industry, and just whatever else we want to talk about that's Nintendo related. going into this, one thing I want to point out is that I am recovering from surgery I just had yesterday, so my voice is still a little scratchy because they had the weird tube thing in my throat. So I will do my best, but I'm going to sound a little funny throughout this thing, I think.
As usual.
As usual, yeah. So as usual, I have the weird voice going on, but hopefully you guys can just deal with it. All right, so anyway, today I'm pretty excited about this episode because we're talking about one of my favorite games and a genuine cult classic, that is Earthbound for the Super Nintendo.
Oh, yes.
Now, Earthbound, a little bit of history here because I think it warrants it for this case, is the second game in the Mother trilogy. And Mother, you know, originally came out on the Famicom way back in the 80s. In Japan, and they actually translated the entire game for U.S. audiences, but at the last minute it was pulled because RPGs didn't really have a much of an audience here. You know, they were just getting warmed up with Dragon Quest, and it was still kind of an unproven concept. Now, when Mother 2 was released, Nintendo decided that they were going to try to localize this under the name Earthbound, and they actually had a really big marketing campaign of $2 million to spread the word about this game, and a lot of promos and Nintendo Power and stuff.
Yeah, it was really something. And I remember seeing ads for it everywhere, and like Nintendo Power went crazy about it. And you'd always see those huge boxes that it came in. yeah. I never played the game back when it originally came out, but I knew about it for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the ad campaign for Earthbound was... you have to understand, like, at the time, this was like... back when Nickelodeon was big, you know, and we had Ren and Stimpy and Rocco, and there were a lot of like boogers and butts.
Yeah, it was all like gross out sort of appeal. Yeah, it was all... they had those scratch and sniff things.
yeah. So basically, Nintendo of America thought, okay, this game has, you know, a boss made of vomit called Master Belch. So let's just focus like 90% of our marketing on that and just run with it.
Yeah.
So essentially, the tagline was like, this game stinks, you know? And, you know, it's worse than being in your gym shorts. It was all stuff like that. It was all this, like, you know, and they have this screenshot of the guy that's like Putin in the theater or whatever. And it's all like that. That's kind of where the marketing was focused. And a lot of people think, you know, the game is kind of weird and quirky and has some of that humor, but it made it sound like, you know, the second coming of Booger Man, really.
It did. Nintendo was kind of all over that in those days, though. Remember that Yoshi's Island commercial?
Yeah.
He's eating all his stuff guys. And he explodes. That was disgusting.
I remember my parents watching the TV when that came on, and they were like, oh, that was horrible. They were so, like, grossed out by that. And, yeah, Nintendo definitely had the whole play it loud. They had the whole grunge thing going on in the 90s. With their ad campaigns. And that definitely spilled over to Earthbound, where they just sort of latched onto the grossest parts of the game and kind of made it sound like it was all like, you know, butts and farts and, you know, like that's the whole game.
Yep.
But in actuality, it caught my attention personally. I mean, I wasn't like, you know, I didn't think it was like the funniest sounding thing ever, but I was like, okay, this sounds kind of neat. I had played Final Fantasy III. The year before that, and I played Dragon Quest before, so I was no, like, real stranger to RPGs. But with Earthbound, the game actually didn't end up doing as well as they hoped. Which they obviously hoped for it to do really well because of the big push it had. And like you said, the game was in a big old box. You know, they packaged this player's guide with it, which I'm sure wasn't cheap. And incidentally, the player's guide was awesome. You know, it was really well made and it's really funny, and it really just kind of immersed you into the world. It made a really great companion to the game. Yeah. So Earthbound ended up selling somewhere around 200,000 copies. And at that point, Nintendo was kind of like, this didn't really do great. So, you know, that's that. So the series, when Mother 3 finally came out for the Game Boy Advance in 2006, Mother 3, of course, was Earthbound 64 initially, and then it got canceled and moved on to GBA. Nintendo of America didn't want to localize it because they felt the series wouldn't sell well enough, you know, to be worth it. It didn't have a big enough installed fan base. So despite, you know, repeated attempts of the community to get in touch with Nintendo and to make them, you know, bring these games over, they basically just kind of ignored the fans for a really long time. And a really good example of this is in Smash Brothers Brawl.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think Chris can explain what happened there, right?
Yeah, in the Japanese version, let me back up a sec. So in Smash Brothers Brawl, there's a feature of the game in which a lot of classic titles are playable, kind of as demo versions, but still they're there.
Yeah.
So you get to play a few minutes of Mario Brothers and Zelda and Earthbound on the Japanese version. But then, for some reason, when they brought it here to America, they deliberately took the time to remove Earthbound from the game.
I mean, it just seems so spiteful.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that they, you know, didn't want to put in extra work to do something. They actually put in extra work to take something out.
And I think actions like that are what led the community to speculate that, well, the reason they must be doing this must be like a copyright thing. Because of the music in the game that people speculated, you know, took inspiration from, like, Beatles songs and things like that.
Right.
They thought that Nintendo was apprehensive about, you know, releasing such a title again because they didn't, you know, they're a conservative company and they wouldn't want to, you know, tread on anyone's toes. But
right.
But like you were saying, recently Nintendo's said publicly that no, that was never a part of it. So I'm confused as to why they really had been so adverse to throwing a bone to the American fans at all.
It's kind of weird, you know. It feels like there's a lot of factors. Because I mean, the music, you know, like you said, there's a lot of Beatles references. There's one song that sounds a whole lot like one of the songs of the band The Who.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it gives the game a lot of its personality. But yeah, I think a lot of people were worried about this, and that kind of is how the rumors started. That Nintendo eventually said no. Like the past few months, someone from Nintendo basically said that wasn't an issue of theirs at all. So sure enough, you know, when the Virtual Console game came out, it's unedited basically. There's no dialogue changes. There's no music changes. The only change is actually in a couple of the PSI animations.
They prompted seizures or something?
Well, they didn't exactly prompt seizures, but I guess they could have. They're very flashy. PSI favorite thing, you know, Rockin', I guess, is what the default is for NES. The Gamma version, the third one. And one of the Star Storms was toned down a little bit in terms of they're made more transparent. But, I mean, that's it, you know? Like, everything else is untouched, so it must be fair game, you know? Like, the Johnny B. Goode hippie theme was there, you know? So, like, what I think it probably is, most likely, is that Nintendo is a very conservative company, and they're worried that if the fans weren't that receptive in the 90s, they won't be that receptive right now.
Yeah, but I mean, that's like 20 years ago, and
yeah,
the sales weren't dismal. They might not have been great, but did the game sell decently in Japan? Do you know what the reception was like over there for the Mother series in general?
It's a little different in Japan. It's kind of odd because Mother 1 is like the big classic game in Japan.
Oh, really?
That's kind of like the timeless classic. Mother 2 is seen as like a really good sequel, but it's not as beloved as Mother 1. And amusingly enough, Mother 3 is kind of like this disappointment to them.
Really?
Yeah. When in America, when I see people's impressions, people think Mother 1 is a little too archaic, Mother 2 is the classic, and Mother 3, depending on who you ask, is even better. So, I mean, the series definitely has a big following in Japan. I mean, it's not huge like Dragon Quest or Pokemon, but it's significant. And, you know, doing no small part to Shigesato Itoi basically being, you know, kind of a big celebrity there. Yeah. And he's the one that infused the game with a lot of its uniqueness. So, anyway, I wanted to talk about Earthbound today because, of course, it was released on the Virtual Console last month. And a few months ago when it was announced, it was like the biggest thing in the world. Like, nobody could believe it because it just kind of came out of nowhere. And it was just such a long time coming that it was just surreal. You know? So, yeah, and it's a surprise. Here it is on the Virtual Console, you know, near the end of July. What's equally as surprising as that, honestly, is the way Nintendo of America is currently handling the series. Like, I would never have expected them to kind of make a nice trailer for it and include the guide online and even have this new Miiverse community called Onet Times where they said they're going to keep you updated with the series. I mean, honestly, all this push, I know they're trying to get more sales because obviously it's a game with a big cult following. But it makes me a little bit optimistic that we might actually see Mother 1 or Mother 3 at some point.
I think that'd be amazing. They're not considering making another Mother game, are they? Is Itoi isn't...
Itoi has said that you know, he's done with the series. You know, he's done the three games and he's satisfied with them. He said he wouldn't be opposed to someone else trying them, but I'm not sure if anyone else is going to, like, jump on that. And I'm not necessarily sure if that should happen. I mean, it's happened with other series, but I think he's a major part of the Mother series, obviously. And I might be good with three games if we get them all.
Sure, sure. And so. the downloads so far, they've sold pretty well, hasn't it, on the Virtual Console?
Yeah, the sales numbers. We don't know the exact sales numbers, but we do know it's number two overall for the Wii U eShop sales, behind only Donkey Kong, which is one of the 30-cent games. So I think that's actually really good. It'd be nice to see it number one, but it's, you know, it's understandable that more people would buy a game for gumball price than one that's $10. But it's still really exciting. It's been that way for 2 months so far. So hopefully it stays high. And you guys listening that have a Wii U, if you haven't bought it yet, I would highly recommend it. So yeah, with that, let's talk about the game specifically.
So Earthbound is plays kind of like a Dragon Quest game. Like the mechanics of the combat it's pretty old school in terms of, you know, selecting attacks and even the
right. It's done in sort of the battles are in the first person view, for instance, where you're looking at the enemies against a background.
Yeah,
you don't see your player, and when you're roaming around on the overworld, or basically the game's equivalent of the overworld, you have that little menu, you know, where you can select talk and check.
You can check everything.
Equip. Yeah, you can check everything. Right. There's also, you know, it's got some modern amenities added to it. Like there's a context sensitive L button, which is an automatic like talk or check.
Oh yeah, anything. I really love that. I don't know why more games don't do that, where you can just, you know, you can play with one hand on the controller basically.
Yeah, it was a nice innovation. Yeah, I've been to Disney World too much. Innovation. It was a nice innovation at the time, and it still works today since you can remap the buttons on the gamepad to where you can still play with one hand using the two shoulder buttons. But additionally, other things that kind of added to the Dragon Quest formula are no random battles, which is a big one.
Yeah.
And it also had this really cool system where you would automatically kill an enemy if you were a good amount stronger than it.
Yeah, so, that removed a lot of the tedium from going through, like, old areas that had weak enemies in them. And they would also run away from you, like in the overworld.
That's right. It was always exciting whenever you could automatically kill an enemy that you've been fighting suddenly because you reached a certain level. Yeah. And it's kind of like, okay, this game doesn't really, you know, it doesn't want to waste my time, you know, fighting these little cannon fodder enemies. And yeah, like you said, they run away once you beat the boss of an area. The enemies are all running from you, so you can go behind them and get the first attack, and often that'll kill them outright. So it feels nice and streamlined compared to the early Dragon Quest games. And even today, there's a lot of those elements are not in RPGs, you know, that I think could benefit from them.
Yeah, I agree. I think the music score in the game is really one of the standout features of the game. The sampling is very unique. All the instruments in the game, I guess if you look at a lot of like Super Nintendo games or Genesis games, a lot of them kind of share the same sound.
They use the same
music libraries or something.
Right.
But Earthbound really doesn't. Everything in the game sounds very unique. And even right now, I haven't played the game in years, but I can still really call back to just the certain you know, notes, certain melodies that really just stand out as being just Earthbound.
Yeah, the game really, in terms of its soundtrack, it really just runs the gamut of all sorts of different genres and sounds. And there's a lot of, unusual for the time, but there was a lot of atmospheric tracks that are just like... They do like a whole lot of that. There's the more melodic tracks, like the town themes, mm-hmm. you know, Onette and Tucson and Threed. And you also have these really funky techno songs. You know, it's got that kind of thing going. And like you said, the sampling really makes you kind of pay attention to like the crazy sounds that are coming out of your Super Nintendo, you know, that you wouldn't hear in other games at the time. You know, most RPGs have that sort of orchestral sound, and Earthbound sort of went in all sorts of different directions.
It really did. I think the story of the game is told in a pretty interesting way too. It's not heavy. It's not really overblown or anything. As an older game, you know, they didn't put the same sort of production value or focus on cinematics like you'd expect today. But
Earthbound's story is just like, it's something that it's kind of hard to describe in that. You're basically, the story is kind of about the journey. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like the game is almost like this big vacation. You know, you're leaving home, you're exploring all these fantastic areas. Fantastic in, you know, the literal sense. And you're kind of growing along with Ness. You know, the main characters, Ness, Paula, Jeff, and Pooh, they barely have more than a few lines apiece. But it feels like these are people you know. They feel like four friends on an adventure. And the story kind of comes from just your adventure that you're having, the characters that you're meeting, the things that you're doing. It just feels very personal to me, and nostalgic and exciting. You know, it's not, like you said, it's not overblown. It's not trying to hype up the melodrama or anything. There's a few parts where it's kind of satirical. And then it sort of comes full circle at the end where everything kind of comes together.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's kind of a simple story behind it all, but it just feels so well realized, and there's just details everywhere in terms of the world building that it really feels like a believable and exciting, albeit strange, world.
Yeah, I mean, not to spoil anything, but I think the villain is you don't really learn much about Gygas until the very end of the game. He's mentioned here and there, and you kind of see his influence, but... you don't really know anything about what he is or what the whole deal is until the very end. But it works in a very interesting way, just because of the nature of Gygas. It's a very big departure in tone from the rest of the game.
That whole end sequence is pretty incredible in that it doesn't feel really like there's really nothing else like it, I think.
Yeah.
And it works for Gygas because, you know, part of a big part of his whole mystique is that element of the unknown.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. So, moving on from that, one really interesting thing about Earthbound I've noticed over the past few weeks is that when the game came out, some reviews kind of blasted it for having very primitive graphics, because at the time. People were playing RPGs for kind of that Lord of the Rings look. They're looking for the kind of the fantasy and the detailed worlds and the dragons and the dungeons. But with Earthbound, it's you know, they go for like this kind of faux retro 90s. I mean, sorry. Like 1950s kind of Americana satire thing. And it's completely different from anything at the time. And so some people are like, this game is ugly, you know? Why would I want to play this? It's just like some kid walking around. It looks like an NES game. But now when I look on Miiverse, people just love the graphics and they love the music. because it's aged really well. It still stands out, and the art style still shines through, even when games like, for instance, Donkey Kong Country are criticized nowadays for looking kind of dated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of fascinating to me how that just kind of flopped around.
I think that's because it was a stylistic choice they made that didn't resonate with, I guess, critics at the time or people who might have complained about the time, because it does look kind of retro. Like, it looks like it could almost be an NES game. It's kind of flat. There's not a lot of depth to the color in a lot of the overworld and the characters and stuff. In the combat segments, I think you get some more detailed art on the enemies and such. But
it's a lot of like pastel colors. There's not a whole lot of shading or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's weird because it almost makes me feel like the games that will be remembered for their art are the ones that are not trying to look the most realistic that they can. Perhaps.
Very true.
Because maybe in 10 years, I mean, who's going to be impressed by, like, you know, the visuals of the latest Call of Duty?
No. Nope.
And by the latest, I mean the latest today, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, people remember Wind Waker a lot more fondly than Twilight Princess in terms of art.
Absolutely. And so, Wind Waker was a game that caught a lot of flack when it was first shown because people objected to the art style. They're like, oh, this isn't Zelda, or this isn't the Zelda we want, or something like that. But
yeah.
But nowadays, everyone... Not only does the game still look fantastic today, to the point where I don't even know why they're making an HD version, because it still looks great. But I think everyone today will look back on it as a great game that's going to live on. Like, everyone's going to continue to remember it as a great-looking game because of the style, not because of the technical feats that were put into it. Because that's what really lasts in terms of the art, like the style of a game. If the visuals are going to have staying power, it's going to be because of the style and the actual, like, artistic effort that went into it, not the technical prowess that the game displays.
Yeah, I think that that's kind of a good thing to keep in mind, I guess, for game developers, because, thinking back to my favorite-looking games, they all have really strong art styles, even if they came from the NES or 16-bit era. So, yeah, I feel like there's so much more to cover for Earthbound, but I don't want this to be too long. I haven't even gotten into the game's like just whole quirky nature yet, but it just feels like one thing after another, like one really creative instance after another. If I think back to something like Chrono Trigger's courtroom scene, it's a really memorable part of the game for me.
Yeah,
because you're doing something very unique and different. And Earthbound often feels like moments like that over and over. Like, you're going to break up a cult that worships the color blue, you know? Mm-hmm. You go to Saturn Valley and fight a giant pile of barf. You know, it's all sorts of just really unusual things that you're doing in this world, but it doesn't feel like just random for the sake of randomness. It really just works together in its own unique way, and it makes the game really stick out to me. It feels cohesive to me.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And that's kind of an interesting thing to say about the game, because cohesion is not really what I would immediately associate with it, because it's so, I don't know if off the wall is the right word, but, you know, everything about it is, it's from the beginning, it's a quirky game. You start, you're a kid and the meteor crashes and you find and you're talking to like a hornet or something.
yeah, Buzz.
Yeah.
But he is not a bee. A bee he is not.
No, he's like an alien or something.
Yeah, he's a creature from the future. Yeah, yeah.
But really, every detail about the game is just a little, like, it makes you go, wait, what?
Yeah, it's like a kind of a skewed version of our world a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of the show Adventure Time, in that what's happening is kind of crazy, but it's pretty normal to the people that live there.
Yeah.
You know, so this is part of their world. This is part of their reality. So, I mean, there's just so many instances in the game that are like this. You know, you find contacts in the desert and you give it to a guy in Foreside to get a pair of stinky socks that you can throw at the enemy, and they're gone after one use, and they're all but useless. All right, there's an apple and an orange kid. The orange kid is this nerdy, like, dude that's just hot stuff. The girls love him. The apple kid's a slob that says he hasn't taken a bath in a while and he asks you for food. But the orange kid doesn't help you at all. He makes this one machine called the Super Orange Machine, or Suporma, which you use it once, it plays the song Ode to Orange Kid, and then it immediately breaks. Meanwhile, the Apple Kid will call you up in the middle of the game and he's like, hey, I got this great invention. And he'll give you this invention that's completely useless, except for the instance that you need it right there. You know, you come up to a giant iron pencil statue, and the Apple Kid's like, hey, I got this thing called the pencil eraser. It can erase any pencil in your path. And it's like, okay, great, because that's exactly what I needed right now. Later he's like, I got some zombie paper. You could spread it on the floor of a tent or something and catch zombies. So it's like, oh, great, that's what I needed. So it's just like, there's so many instances in the game that are just like, just, I don't know, man. They just stick out to me, and they're really fun. It's like a weird, bizarro version of Peanuts or something, all in an RPG, like, wrapping. Just buy it. It's a good game.
It's a very great. Good game.
Yeah. For now, we will move on to our next section. And this is where we talk about things that bug us a little bit. And it's called,
why did it do that? Why did it do that?
So today I'm going to talk about why did they do that, because I'm feeling a little frustrated. Now, I don't want to be one of those guys that says, oh, Nintendo, I used to love Nintendo, but they were great until the GameCube days and the Wii days, and they started making stupid games. But I was not really thrilled with what's going on at E3. Okay, so it's a little late for E3 talk, and I know that the first why did they do that section was me complaining about a guy complaining about the Wii U.
Yep.
But
now you're that guy.
Now I'm that guy. What have I become? I've become everything I hate. Here's the thing. Every year after Nintendo, like the year after they release a big system, they always have an awesome E3 with it. Like the Wii had the, you know, Galaxy and Metroid Corruption and some other stuff. Yeah, so they had some exciting games for the E3 afterwards. I really wanted them to blow us away at E3, and it wasn't quite there for me. I feel like I'm really excited about Smash Brothers. I'm really excited about Mega Man, but I really wanted to see more games that use the Wii U gamepad, because that's kind of the whole big selling point of the system. And what we got instead were, I feel like they're trying to replicate the success of the 3DS with the Wii U, but I don't know if it's going to work. Like, I wanted to see Galaxy 3, like, or, you know, the next big Mario game.
Yeah, instead we got Mario 3D World, which could be a 3DS game for all I care, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I want to be more excited than I am for Mario 3D World, but it's just, I like 3D Land a lot, but that's a 3DS game, you know? If it was released on a home system, I don't think it would be as, I mean, I know it doesn't sound fair, but it's not Mario Galaxy to me. It's not a big, grandiose adventure that pushes the platforming genre forward and has, like, the best soundtrack ever. All right? That's kind of what I was expecting the Wii U Mario to be. I wanted the next level of platforming. But we got a game that, you know, like you said, could pretty much be done on the 3DS with some, you know, with some downgrades, obviously. And four-player multiplayer I like multiplayer in Mario. It's fun, but it's not like what I want them to build the game around.
No.
And it sounds kind of like they built the game around this. So really my main complaint is really with Mario. Because, I mean, I did want to see Metroid, but I actually really like Donkey Kong Country Returns a lot. So, I mean, I'm pretty excited for Donkey Kong still. And I'm pretty excited for, well, okay, Pikmin 3 just came out. And I've been playing that, and it's, like, super fun. But I still wanted to see more gamepad integration, because there was, like, none, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted to see something really creative, and Nintendo Land used it in really creative ways, and I love Nintendo Land. But, you know, it's time for, like, Mario should be awesome! That's the thing! All right, this extends to, like, my feelings about the Mario series. Like, it used to be every Mario game was awesome. Then it was every console Mario game was awesome. Then it was every console Mario platformer was awesome.
Yeah.
Then it was every console Mario 3D platformer was awesome. You see, we have to keep adding these little things, these little modifiers, because we've gotten four new Super Mario Brothers games, and, I mean, they're decent, you know, but they're like, Nintendo's not really trying that hard with them, to be honest.
You could say the same about Zelda, you know, that it's more and more qualifiers have to be added to the phrase, oh, all Zeldas are awesome, well, all console Zeldas are awesome, and now...
Well, to be fair with Zelda, I mean, at least, you know, like Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword and Wind Waker and Majora's Mask and Ocarina of Time, they're all 3D Zeldas, but they feel different and they look different from each other and they have different areas.
That's true.
Like, here's my problem with New Super Mario Brothers. There are four games in the series, four and a half if you count Luigi, and they all use the same eight worlds. Every one of them. They use the same eight worlds. They use grass, desert, water. If I see another desert world in Mario, I'm going to shoot myself. I mean, how is this still interesting? I know people work hard on these games. I know the level design is really smart. All right. I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
But this is like fast food Nintendo, you know? It's not lasting. I don't feel like in 20 years I'm going to be like, oh, I really want to play New Super Mario Brothers 2 today.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Like, it feels really disposable. You know, I want there to be, I want Mario to be like, every Mario game to be awesome. And it's just, when you reuse assets and when you reuse music, that's not even that good, to be honest.
Yeah.
And you have the same, like, worlds and, like, some boss battles are reused, and it's like the art style is kind of like Mario Party, kind of plasticky. Like,
there's no character to it.
Some character to it, but it's old character. It's like, it's like I can clearly tell the difference between a Mario Galaxy 2D like level. You know how sometimes it goes in the side scroller, and New Super Mario Brothers. Levels. There's just a clear difference in terms of art style and lighting and effort to me. And it's just, I know 3D Land and 3D World are done by EAD Tokyo and they're different games, but this is not what Mario needs right now. We just got through three new Super Mario Brothers games, if you count Luigi. So it's time for Mario to come back and make something really awesome to usher in the Wii U, because if Nintendo doesn't utilize the gamepad, who will, honestly?
I'm worried that it's going to turn into a gimmicky thing. Like you look at the Wii, and some games use the Wiimote in an interesting way, but most really didn't.
And it's usually Nintendo games that do that. They're kind of the guys that came up with this, so they usually have really good ideas. And here's the thing. I really like the Wii U. I really like the gamepad. I like pretty much everything about the system except that the fact that it doesn't really have games. I think there's a lot of great things they could do with the gamepad, but for some reason they seem to like be playing it like super safe with it right now. Like even Pikmin 3, which has the map and the go here function, which is great.
Yeah.
The best way to play it is with the Wiimote and Nunchuck, because you can point at the screen and have the gamepad kind of at your side. So I'm actually going to talk more about Pikmin 3 at a later podcast, so I don't want to get too deep into that. But coming back to the main point here, I think Nintendo, this is the time for Nintendo to really fire on all cylinders, and I don't feel their output is that's coming up feels, you know, like must-have stuff right now.
Yeah, I really expected more as well. Honestly, by this point, I expected them to do something like they did with the 3DS when they cut the price and, you know, gave the extra downloadable games to people who had already purchased it. Because, I mean, the sales have been low and we've heard bad things from publishers. And I'm kind of surprised that they haven't in some way, like, you know, shown that they're all in for the Wii U and they're, you know, really going to support it, because it's just been kind of mediocre news after bad news after, you know, nothing sounds good that's coming out for the Wii U. I've heard they're going to discontinue, I guess, the basic Wii U, and I don't know what else they're going to do, but that's some of the speculation I've read, which I think would be a good idea, because 8 gigabytes is really not enough for the storage space, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the basic Wii U didn't... I mean, it didn't really sell well compared to the other one. So, I mean, they don't really need the two SKUs in general. I think a price drop would really help. If they bring it somewhere like... Right now, it's $350. If they bring it, like, below $300, like, a little bit more than $299, like, maybe $279 or something.
Yeah.
I think that would help a lot with their holiday games. And, I mean, the games that are coming out around Christmas, you know, they're pretty good, but, like... I can't really get excited about Wind Waker HD, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm fairly excited about Donkey Kong, but I could be, you know, more excited just because it looks really detailed. I mean, it looks nice. It just feels like it'll play kind of samey to me. And I think it used the Nunchuck and Wiimote for some reason. Like, where's the gamepad usage? Come on.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people really wanted Metroid Prime using the gamepad, and I think that would actually be really cool. So...
Yeah, I would think so too.
Maybe next
but who's going to make it? I mean, if Retro's doing Donkey Kong right now, which is going to have Dave Wise doing the music, so I'm at least excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, that was like the one thing, that and the shake to roll mechanic were like the two problems I had with Returns. But I guess once that releases, you know, Retro can work on something else.
I hope so, but I mean, I hope they could do something original instead of just churning out Metroid and Donkey Kong games. I mean, they're great, but, you know, I think that would be kind of wasting them if...
Yeah, a lot of people have been wanting an original Retro IP, like if Ravenblade ever got resurrected or something. But yeah, so that's my little rant. It's and I really, one game could change it all, like, for me. It would make me feel less weird about E3 and more excited about the Wii U's future. Mm-hmm. And that game is Mario. If they release, like, Mario Universe or whatever this Christmas, you know, with gamepad usage, that was really exciting, and the whole game looked like awesome adventure, I'd be very, you know, I'd be very happy about this year.
Yeah, I think that's really what the Wii U did need. I'm also disappointed that they went the route that they did. I think the sales for the new Super Mario Brothers games have been very good. I can only speculate that they got to be looking at this from a financial standpoint and saying, well, these games are really popular. Mario 3D Land is really popular. And like from a game design standpoint, Mario 3D Land is pretty similar to the new Super Mario Brothers games. It does a lot more, and it's a refreshing like take on it. But the structure of the game is pretty similar.
Well, that's... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, so I just think they probably were thinking, well, New Super Mario Bros. Is selling really well. 3D Land sold really well, so it'll be a pretty easy transition to just make another 3D Land-style game, and that people will be receptive to it.
I guess the issue with that is that they released New Super Mario Bros. U already as a launch game. And as far as most of us were concerned, it was kind of a stopgap between the next big Mario game, you know?
Absolutely.
Now, they expected that to sell systems, and I'm sure it sold some systems, but I think with the stellar sales of New Super Mario Bros. On the DS and on the Wii, it's kind of a chicken or egg thing where, you know, did they really push systems, or did people with the systems be like, oh, okay, I guess I'll buy this because it's Mario and it's going to be fun?
And there's nothing else to buy.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if people are rushing out to buy a whole system because of a new Super Mario Brothers game.
No.
You know? It's more people that already have the Wii are like, okay, this, you know, this will be fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at this point, you know, if they keep reusing these worlds and not making it look particularly interesting, people are going to be like, you know, I already have a couple of these. I don't really need more.
Right.
You know, I don't feel the need to buy another new Super Mario Brothers game. That's why I didn't buy Luigi U, even though a lot of people really like it.
You have the Wii U one, right?
I have the Wii U one, but I didn't buy the Luigi one because I'm tired of going through the freaking desert. Good grief. How interesting. Desert. There's so many deserts. It's like desert, and then it's like snow level, and then it's like sky level and mountain level. Why not have like a candy level? How about that?
Well,
here, Nintendo, here's eight new worlds for you. Candy, music, cows, this is harder than I thought it would be.
Computers.
But there's computers there. Do a factory one.
Yeah.
Do an upside down one. Do a space one. I'm just thinking of Mario Galaxy things now. That's because Mario Galaxy had awesome levels, all right? One
and
two.
Yeah.
They both had a bunch of unique worlds, and they weren't just freaking jungle and freaking volcano again. All right, sorry.
No, but you raise a lot of good points.
I raise a loud voice.
Yes, you raise a lot of loud points. You're clearly very passionate about this.
I love Mario so much. He's just such a great guy.
He
deserves games that are the king of platformers. And like, I almost feel more excited about Sonic's game than Mario's. And I just feel dirty saying that. So shame on you, Nintendo, for making me say that.
Sonic does look pretty good. I mean, it looks like a Galaxy-style game, I guess.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's a pretty good compliment.
I mean, if they can make the camera and controls work well, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I could see that being really fun. So, all right. Well, enough of that. Anyway, let's move on. Let's move on to our comic discussion. Comic talk.
Okay,
so it's been kind of a while, so there's a lot of comics. I don't think I want to talk about all of them right now because that would just take way too long, and I don't know if I have a ton to say about every one of these, but I will talk about a few of them. First of all, let's talk about 496. Here comes Frederick.
Okay.
So this is about the Jagan-type characters in Fire Emblem. A little confession, though. I just started doodling. It was kind of like the Waluigi thing, where I came up with this one attribute for a character and just started doodling all these comic ideas without thinking about it too hard. And I came up with three comics that I really liked for Here Comes Frederick. So I was like, well, I could make him one big comic, or I could spread them out. So guess which one I picked. So yeah, this is the first of the three, and the other one was actually the third of the three. I don't know if I'm ever going to put up the second of the three or not. I really like it, but I don't know if it stands on its own as well. But there's that. And yeah, I designed this guy around kind of that Hey Arnold art style, because I love Hey Arnold, and I don't know if I really had a reason beyond that. So, 477, B-Royale and the Family. This one is the big April Fool's comic, and April Fool's Day always kind of makes me nervous these days, because you have people that are like, no more Waluigi, and you have people like, oh, Waluigi's gotta show up, and it's like, oh man, I don't know if, like, I can, I don't want to just do the same joke, you know? I want to use Waluigi, but I gotta find new ways to use them, you know?
Yeah.
So you're not like using the same thing. So the boards actually wanted, some of the mods on the boards wanted to do this sort of thing where they just talked about the Battle Royale, PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale, which of course released on the PlayStation 3 and was basically the Sony Smash Brothers. For one day, they would rename all the parts of the board that and, you know, change their avatars and stuff. And they wanted the comic to be linked into that. So I was thinking, oh, you know, I could give it a shot, even though I don't really know a whole lot about these franchises. So I made a bunch of different comics that just kind of involved all these different characters, and most of them were just really goofy and silly, but people seemed to like them, and I even got to work in Waluigi at the end, so I was happy about that. yeah, I want to talk about this one too. 483, Mr. Game & Watch meets Paper Mario. I'm not sure how I think this started off as a few panels, and then I was like, you know what? I'm gonna just draw three lines and see how that works as a single panel comic. And it was the quickest comic I've ever had to draw, which is kind of awesome. So I got this little extra time. But I honestly really like it. I'm really proud of this one, because it's just, What's the fewest amount of lines I can draw to make a joke, you know? And I guess the answer is three.
You should challenge yourself to reduce it further.
I think if I did that, people would start being like, okay. It's kind of like that. There's like a Calvin and Hobbes where Calvin draws like this. It looks like just a little kind of dot. And he's like, hey, Hobbs, you know what this is? It's a polar bear blinking in a snowstorm.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was really clever, you know? So I guess that's really the quickest, the smallest amount. But it was pretty close with three lines. One horizon and two characters. All right, 485, The Squeaky Wheel. This is my big dedication. When Earthbound was released, I knew I had to make a comic about it. So this is kind of my big thank you to all the guys at Starman.net and just the Earthbound community, overall, because I mean, what they've done over the years has been just ridiculous in terms of their support for the game and their love of the game. There's like thousands of images out there, thousands, probably, well, maybe hundreds of songs, remixes, and just tons of letters and things that they've done over the years. It looks like Miiverse was actually the straw that broke the camel's back, but I think, you know, I really wanted to have a big just dedication to that whole fan base, because they're the ones that helped make it possible.
Yeah, they are super fanatical about that series, and I think it's been really cool. I mean, I haven't really been a part of it myself, but just to see, like, you know, they mail, how many thousands of signatures did they mail to Nintendo of America for Mother 3?
Oh man, I'm sure it was in the...
Was it like 300,000 or something?
I'm sure it was in the six-digit number somewhere.
Yeah, it was a lot. So
I mean, not only that, but they actually made an entire, like, bound book full of fan art and stuff, and sent like one to eToy and two to Nintendo,
and they're really high quality.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talented people there, so this is like my little kudos to them because of you know, celebration of the game being released. Moving on is 487 Sonic's Eyes. I just think Sonic's eyes are weird. They're connected, and there's just a bunch of visual things I could do with that. I guess I don't really have much else to add about them. They are weird, though. I mean, does he have, like, one giant eyeball that sits in his skull?
I don't think the games have ever explored that.
Well, here's the thing. It looks weird now because he's, like, interacting with real people.
Yes.
And he's this giant hedgehog, you know? Like, before, in the 16-bit days, when he's like, okay, he's like a cartoony guy, and he's like interacting with Robotnik, who's big and fat, and he's kind of weird cartoony guy.
Yeah.
But now it's like there's other real humans, and he's standing next to him, and it just really makes you wonder about his anatomy more than you ever would have otherwise.
Absolutely so. I think the way they've taken the series, like, towards more realistic depictions of people and stuff, I really don't like the way that's happened, because it's, you can, you know, look it up on YouTube, some of these cutscenes that has like Sonic interacting with some like girl who he's supposed to have like a romantic interest in or something.
Yeah, everyone always brings up that girl that he kisses.
Just so weird.
To be fair, that was a few years ago. It seems they're kind of straying from the real cities and people and stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right. But the thing is, I think historically in Japan, that's been true to the canon of Sonic, like him and real people and stuff, like the Western, like, cartoony things, like with Robotnik and like the TV cartoons and like the comic books, those were very different from the Japanese versions of those.
Really?
So I think the Japanese probably didn't have as much of a problem with that, like the Sonic 2006, as we did.
It just doesn't feel right. It feels like it clashes, you know?
No, I agree.
It's like a clash of styles. It's just bizarre to me. It's like Smash Brothers, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, Smash Brothers, it's intentional. And Sonic, it's like, oh, it's really, I don't know. Yeah, he's Sonic was designed that way because of, it's kind of like Felix the Cat and like old school Mickey Mouse and the Animaniacs, where they have that really large sort of brow and facial area that's white, because that's a very expressive way to convey, you know, a character's emotions and things. And that, he was kind of designed with that old-school sensibility in mind. But yeah, when you mix that with, like, realistic people, it's like, what?
That's bizarre.
It's like a giant Mickey, you know, walking around and talking with, like, holding hands with Walt Disney.
Yeah.
Which is a statue, I guess. But yeah. All right, let's move on. The truth about Zeebs, or Zebus. I always said Zeebs, though. I mean, I like Zeebs a lot better. It sounds more alien to me. Yeah, this is Comic 490, and I'm trying to remember how... I was playing a lot of Super Metroid when they released it for 30 cents. Like, I did a few speedruns in a row, but I started noticing a lot of weird similarities between the game and Mario, so I thought, man, wouldn't it be weird if this was, like, the Mushroom Kingdom in the future, and it's all, like, overrun with vegetation and alien life forms and no people? And I just thought that was kind of fascinating and a little bit depressing, so I made it a comic!
Yeah, I really like the concept behind that, and I think you drew the parallels pretty well. I just like the transitions between all the different creatures.
Yeah, that was kind of fun thinking of, because, I mean, there's actually Buzzy Beetles in the game, even, you know? In Super Metroid.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even think was... I had brought up in the comic, but yeah. Kind of neat. I want to also talk about the 494 Political Strife, which is an Animal Crossing one that came out around the time Animal Crossing did. It's kind of the gritty version of Animal Crossing, which was really fun to draw, but something I'm not entirely used to. And I really like drawing Isabelle as an actual Shih Tzu. I thought that ended up looking really ridiculous. And, you know, the contrast with what you're actually doing with the... Yeah. But yeah, you just kind of become mayor in that game. They're like, hey, you're the mayor. And then you get a letter from the real mayor later.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that they're so eager to entrust their town to some guy they have no idea who he is.
Yeah. But, I mean, you end up doing a good job. The last mayor didn't do anything. He didn't plant, like, enough trees. Or if he did, he just planted them all willy-nilly. He didn't put down any paths. Barely put flowers, and like no one lived there.
Yeah, but the way this town works, basically they expect the mayor to not only do everything but pay for everything too. Like the townsfolk really don't contribute very much to the proceedings.
They don't just expect you to pay for everything. They expect you to deliver your sweater to their animal friend, like who's two screens over.
Yeah, they're a demanding bunch. It's not really a very good job, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't even have a salary or anything.
I know.
Just kind of show up and pay for streetlights. No wonder they're so eager to make a mayor. It's like, hey, you can be the mayor. Yeah, it sounds prestigious, but you're really just working for the Isabelle the whole time.
Yeah. It's really a raw deal.
Oh, well. So, at $4.95, I made an E3 comic, and kind of officially welcomed in the newcomers to the strip. And this is really cool because this is the first time ever where a new Smash Brothers has been announced while Brawl in the Family is going. You know, while it's happening, while I'm drawing it. So it's like, okay, I mean, I guess I can work in new characters in the strip now, you know? So even though they've all appeared at some point, the Animal Crossing Villager and Wii Fit Trainer and Mega Man, it's really exciting to see them. And I kind of made the little welcome for both of them right after E3 kind of revealed them. So Trainers was $4.96. They kind of had her interacting with Pokemon Trainer. And then, where is the other one? Oh, Pockets, right after that, $4.97, where Animal Crossing Villager is kind of using his powers to take care of Red. And, of course, 500 is the last comic I want to talk about today, which is Prodigal Robot. And I don't know if I stressed this enough in the blog, but this gave me a lot of stress. Like, honestly, I had no idea what I was doing for Comic 500, and people kept saying, hey, I can't wait to see what's coming up for Comic 500. And this is like, you know, maybe 3 weeks before it, and I had three or four different ideas, but I wasn't really satisfied with any of them. So finally I sat down, like, all right, what do I feel really strongly about right now? You know, what's something I could write about and feel really, you know, passionate about? And it kind of came back to Mega Man and his big reveal in Smash Brothers. And I thought that was just kind of a poetic thing, because if you think about Mega Man's story, like, he had these games, he was this great, you know, video game character in the NES days. He was, you know, you had Mario, you had Link, you had Mega Man. It was like a classic Nintendo character, even though he wasn't made by Nintendo. It was still, you know, a very beloved character, and it's great to see him finally come back after just all these games getting canceled and him kind of being all but forgotten by Capcom. So I thought, you know, I'm gonna make a comic about that. It'll be a big Mega Man tribute, and it'll end with the Smash Brothers trailer. So that's what I did, and people seem to like it. I'm kind of surprised when people say that they cried from something Brawl in the Family did, but I guess when they have that kind of emotion tied to certain characters and memories, you know, that can be a cathartic thing. So I'm glad that I was able to you know, reach people, I guess, with that comic.
Yeah, I think that's something you've been pretty effective at a number of times. Like with It Only Takes a Lifetime was a standout one. But I mean, with that, you're really going for the emotion, I guess. But in Old Dominions, like, you got a lot of comments about people being really moved by that, even though that was still kind of a jokey, you know, kind of humorous song.
Yeah, it's kind of funny with Old Dominions. I was kind of trying to be melodramatic with it, but I think it ended up being still a little bit sad. Which wasn't the original intention, but I guess I'm glad that people are respecting the minions now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, with Prodigal Robot, you know, I don't want things to get too treacly or is that a word, treacly? I think it's a word. I'm gonna call it a word.
Okay.
Or too saccharine, but I did want my affection for Mega Man to come through in this video, and you know the excitement of having him back with the Nintendo crew, and in the comic.
As someone who hasn't, when I was a kid, the only Mega Man game I actually played was this really crappy one for MS-DOS.
That one's pretty infamous now.
Yeah.
I remember you telling me in like 7th grade, you know, I played this Mega Man, it wasn't very good. I'm like, which one was it? You know, like, I don't know, Mega Man 3 or something. I couldn't control him, right? And he just kept jumping. And I was like, what in the world? I had no idea what you were talking about.
So it was a bizarre this game. You started off... first of all, there's no music in the game, as far as I recall. You just start off, like, running across this field, and you're shooting some sort of weird robots. I don't think you gain power-ups. You basically just have the regular, you know, shot that Mega Man has. it was a lot of weird jumping puzzles, and it was very difficult. I recall there were some kind of bosses, but you never really got to... I don't think you got to pick... which bosses you fought.
What's the story behind these? Is it like, was it just like an unlicensed kind of thing? Or was Hotel Mario kind of, where they license them out to some developer that doesn't know anything about them?
It might have been that.
I
believe they were official releases. I don't remember seeing like the Capcom logo, but I could be mistaken. I was a kid when I was when mm-hmm. I played that.
I've seen footage of those games. They're a mess.
They are.
They're nothing like the Mega Man that we know and love.
But that kind of colored my opinion of Mega Man for a while, because we had that on my computer as a kid, and I'm like, oh, that's Mega Man. That's kind of not very fun.
That's like playing Wand of Gamelon is like your only Zelda
game. Kind of,
game.
Yeah. It was only later that one of my friends had Mega Man X, and I played a little bit of that, and I enjoyed it well enough, but I don't know if it like recalled too many memories of the previous one, where it just like it just felt kind of distasteful for some reason. So it wasn't until, I don't know, like 5 years ago that I think you bought me like Mega Man 2 and 2 or 3 on the Virtual Console, and I played through that, and I really enjoyed it. And then I played Mega Man 9, and I remember we played through a bunch of the Mega Mans on your anthology collection, most notably X6, which...
Oh my gosh. We need to make a podcast about X6. that should be one of the games, like one of the featured games.
I think I would very much enjoy talking about that game. It's a very interesting title.
All the games we've talked about so far are, you know, we've had a lot to say, and I think we have a lot to say about X6.
Yeah, I think we should definitely consider that.
All right. Next will be Pikmin 3, but at some time in the future, we need to cover X6 for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think that covers all the comics.
The other kind of topic we were thinking about discussing was like timelessness in games, you know? And what makes a game like last forever, and what makes a game be forgotten within the span of a few short years?
Yeah, this is kind of interesting because we touched upon this with the Earthbound comments, but a big part of it, I think, is that, you know, it has to still stand out in some way even years later, and it's a little unfair because a lot of games that are really great at the time may not be so great after some time passes and they're improved upon by subsequent games, for instance.
Yeah. When you have games like, I don't know, Call of Duty or something where they, you know, the developer just makes another one each year that is going to be better than the last one, those games very quickly fall out of relevance because there's just a better version of them.
Just go to like your local game store and see how many sports games there are.
Yeah, yeah. And
how cheap they are. It's like not even like just like GameCube and PlayStation 2 and PlayStation 3. It's like way back in like the Super Nintendo days too. You have like all these basketball and football games.
Yeah, the sports games have pretty much always been that way. I don't think with other games, it's been quite as common until kind of recently. I mean, with I think Call of Duty Guitar Hero is a good example where they just kind of re-released, you know, it several times.
It feels like you have a game and you kind of Activision's kind of big on that.
Mm-hmm.
Where they get a game with really good reviews and so they release it kind of yearly and it keeps getting really good reviews because it's not, you know, really worse than the past one.
Yeah.
So reviewers are like obligated to be like, okay, it made some improvements. You know, Tony Hawk 2 gets a 10 out of 10, yeah. You know? But I mean, these days, like, I mean, you're not going to go back and be like, play Tony Hawk 2 and be like, wow, this is a pinnacle of game design. I mean, Tony Hawk was really good, but it is one of those annual installments that you're talking about where you really just need one of those games.
Right, right. You're not really going to get a drastically different experience. I mean, well, Tony Hawk's in specific, like the first three or four games are very similar. And then they started doing some other stuff. I guess they were trying to mix it up and make mm-hmm. it a little different or something, but it kind of fell flat on its face. I think that was
a series that got overexposed too.
Yeah, it was not only the fatigue that everyone had. It's like, oh great, another Tony Hawk game. But then the games just stopped being even as good as the previous ones. So it didn't just backfire. It suffered from both of those things. If the series continues to be good, then people will probably still play it to some regard. But if they start messing it up, then the fact that there's been so much of the series is going to compound with the fact that the new game isn't that good. And people are just going to give up on it.
I think a good way to avoid that is to give the series a rest for a few years and then bring it back in a big way.
Sure, sure. I mean, you can keep a series going for as long as you want if you just don't cram it down everyone's throats and make people sick of it. And you know, focus on each title and try to make it, you know, something worthwhile, something that's going to stand on its own two legs, not just based on the strength of the brand or something. I mean, we were discussing, you know, the new Super Mario Brothers series, which is kind of falling into that category.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree there.
They're just, you know, their motivation is, well, we'll just make a new Super Mario Brothers game, and people will buy it, and, you know, it'll be fine. And, you know, they're all fine games, I guess, but I have no interest in playing another one, and I'm sure plenty of other people feel the same way.
Well, it's just because, yeah, and in the case of Super Mario Brothers, new Super Mario Brothers, it definitely falls into that pattern because people, I mean, you'll play it and have fun, but it's getting to the point where, you know what to expect. You kind of can get some of that, elsewhere now that more platformers are being made, and it kind of comes down to, like, when I played Donkey Kong Country Returns, I just kept comparing it to New Super Mario Brothers, and it just was much better in just about every way. I mean, the controls were a little funnier, but besides that, like, the levels were a lot more creative and they're just so much more dynamic in terms of what happened.
Yeah.
So every new Super Mario Brothers game I played after that just felt a little stale and lifeless in comparison with what they could be doing, you know, with a platformer in 2012.
Things like that make me, I don't know. I feel like the developers aren't even really trying that hard to push the boundaries or to come up with some really new ideas. Like, I mean, like you said, the new Super Mario Brothers games do have pretty good level design, but I mean, that's not really changing anything about the way platformers are done. You know, it's making for a pleasantly enjoyable platformer, but
yeah,
I mean,
everything's kind of safe. Like, it looks safe and it sounds safe.
On one hand, I can appreciate the fact that there are always going to be new gamers who haven't played old Mario games. And, you know, for them to be introduced to Mario through a new Super Mario Brothers game I can appreciate that they could get a lot out of it that we might not, because we're a little jaded on the Mario formula in that sense. You know, we've played, you know, dozens of Mario games, and by this point, it's not going to impress us to do the same thing over and over again. So I can almost, like, sort of understand them wanting to have one niche of their product offerings be games that, you know, might be easy for them to make, but will also appeal to a lot of fans who might not have played a lot of Mario before. But at the same time, like, it's just kind of boring to anyone who's been in the gaming scene for a while for it to seem like the developer doesn't really have a fire in their belly to, you know, make some really interesting game. That's just kind of boring to me. Like, I get excited about a developer who has, you know, some innovative ideas and wants to push the medium forward in some way. That's what I'm interested in as far as games are concerned these days. And a lot of the big franchises, I don't get that from.
Yeah, it feels like every big game that's revealed mm-hmm. is either a first-person shooter or a third-person, like, film-like action-adventure
yeah,
game.
Yeah, that's popular.
Or a sandbox, like, violent game. It's like one of those three, and it's like, why can't, you know, the next big game be, like, this really awesome puzzle game or, I don't know, like, a strategy game? I don't know, like, a big RPG or a shoot-em-up? I mean, it'll never happen.
Well, I think it's
That's like what's trendy right now.
Yeah, yeah, and those are kind of the safe formulas, like the new Tomb Raider or the Uncharted games, and other similar action games where it's very cinematic. Like you're basically watching half the game rather than playing it. It gives you the illusion of playing it because usually you have to like press a button at the right time or you just press forward to keep moving forward. But it's not. There's no like. I find that pretty boring. It'd probably be more interesting as a movie. Than as a gameplay experience because they're not doing anything interesting from a gameplay perspective, and I don't think that makes an interesting game. I think that's just kind of lazy. But a lot of people do enjoy that, and the production value is obviously pretty good on those games. So I can appreciate it being appealing to a lot of people, which is why they make it. I mean, these are businesses; they're trying to make money. I think that's kind of the problem with a lot of these. Series that are just doing the same thing over and over again and are not standing out from one another. It's because all this money's riding on the game and they can't afford to do something that could, you know, lose them a ton of money.
Yeah, that's why a lot of people are talking about the whole whole bloat of the game development field is either the market might crash on itself if this keeps up because you have to keep making bigger and bigger budget games that have to stand out. So regarding our original topic, do you think these kind of games will stand the test of time?
I really don't. I think games like Call of Duty or the new most Tomb Raider games, honestly, are not really going to be remembered in 10 or 20 years. I think the reason that we do remember games like Final Fantasy VI or Earthbound or, you know, Mario Galaxy are because those games all carved out a pretty unique niche in the gaming market. Just in the history of games, like those games kind of stand out as being unique. You know, they not only had unique themes to them, they innovated a lot in terms of the world design and the gameplay and just the character of the games. I mean, that's kind of an intangible asset, like the character of a game. But I know you value that in games. You like to,
definitely.
You know, you can it. It's hard to describe, but if you have a game that really means a lot to you,
reasons why a game will resonate with you that can be hard to describe. But I mean, Earthbound is definitely one that feels that way, that has a ton of character to its world and to just, it feels like a ton of love and detail was poured into the game.
And that feel, that's like a combination of like the music and the art and how you experience it through the interaction of the game. Like it's kind of a complex formula to, you know, create that feel of character.
Yeah. And a lot of it has to do with the interactivity. Uh-huh. Like a lot of the details in Earthbound, you have to discover yourself. You have to find the sesame seeds in the desert.
You know? You know,
it's not like you watch a cutscene and this element is, displayed.
Exactly. That's what I don't enjoy about a lot of these modern games. It's basically a roller coaster ride. Like, you know, you're just going from point A to point B, and the game basically forces you to watch things that are happening, like, you know, some big buildings exploding or something. And that's, I'm sure that's technically impressive, but it's just like, okay, this is not really an interactive experience. I'm not, like, discovering something on my own. I'm just sitting here in my seat and being shown this thing.
Yeah.
I find it... I would far prefer... to be able to, you know, find a little detail in the world that somehow fleshes it out for me and just read a couple of lines of text rather than watch some plane crash into a building in front of me that everyone else who plays the game is going to see as well because you're in, you know, you barely have any control over what your character is doing at the time. I think interactivity with the game is something that a lot of the modern games that are trying to be safe kind of sacrifice.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that I mean, that's true. It's like they're trying to be too movie-like. And, you know, if we wanted a movie, we can watch a movie.
And I don't think that's going to really stand out in the future because the things that those games succeed with is pretty much the technical impressiveness of what they're doing. Like,
yeah, at the time, you know, what's technically impressive.
But it's not their stories. It's not their dialogue. It's not their characters. It's those things are not going to be remembered in a few years. Yeah. Like, no one's going to want to play Modern Warfare 2 single player, you know, campaign again, like, ever.
All right. Well, I think that might wrap it up for another edition of the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
But yeah, in conclusion, play some Earthbound, guys. It's a good game.
Yes, everyone should go buy it.
Yeah, we got to support the series. You know, this is the first time we got anything Mother related in the U.S. since, well, technically since the Mother 3 iTunes album, or 3 Plus. But before that, Earthbound itself on the Super Nintendo. So please buy it so we can get more of the series, because it's awesome. And also, it's a really good game. You'll enjoy it. I promise you.
I also promise.
Yeah, see, we both promise. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. And by the time you hear this, Brawl and the Family should be back and running with Comic 501.
Now it's that time again for all you cool, cool cats to relax to the sounds of Music Break. Today's tune comes in the form of an Earthbound homage brought to you by our very own Matthew Toronto. So just kick back and let the dulcet tones of the music flow through your soul. Aw, yeah.
So I will see you around as I make comics, and Chris will be there too somewhere.
Somewhere in the ether.
Yes. Also, buy stuff from the store. I have a lot of books here, and we need space in our garage. Thank you. Oh, speaking of that, I'm thinking about Brawl in the Family version 2, or volume 2, or whatever I'm going to call it. So,
awesome.
Not sure exactly how that's going to go down, but... It's in my head right now. It's happening. All right. Oh, also, one reader comment. When I posted up the art for the podcast, one of our readers said, "Why is Chris's head so big?" Now, Chris, why is your head so big?
That's how I was born.
It's a mystery, I think.
No, it's probably genetics. Pretty much all the men on my dad's side have had large heads. And
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
My dad has a large head. Grandfather's large head, and so forth.
Is it like the dominant gene or the recessive gene? Like, if I did a Punnett square, would the head be a capital H or a lowercase H?
I don't know.
I think it's very dominant.
In my life, it's very dominant. Yes.
You should get married and have kids with large heads.
Yeah, no, that's quite an idea. I'll consider it.
you could go to like Disney World or whatever with your family, and it'll look like a bunch of balloons. It'd be cool.
Yeah, that's always been a thing. When did you were the one who started calling me Big Head? That must have been what, 7th grade?
Honestly, I don't think I noticed right away until you brought it up. You're like, I have a big head, and I was like, huh, yeah, I guess you do. I'm gonna call you Big Head the rest of your life.
It's not really what you, it's not what people would notice immediately upon seeing me, but the various side effects are that I pretty much can't wear any hats. There are very few hats that will fit me. I remember. In marching band in high school, they had to actually take the larger size hat and simply cut open the entire back of it so it would fit on my head. So they couldn't even sew it together. It was just this giant, you know, opening in the back of the hat.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Yep.
Well, things could always be worse. You could have butt problems like me.
No, I prefer large head problems than
I have problems with problems. My butt.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I came up with that cartoony version of Chris sometime in middle school, and it's kind of stuck around ever since.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's a pretty cool looking guy. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us, and we're gonna try to actually do these more frequently.
Sounds good to me.
I will. I'll start planning the next one while I draw my comic. So see you around.
All right. See everybody. Have a great one, and bye, Earthbound.
Bye, Earthbound. All right, so this is weird. Sarah got a call from a number the other day that said blocked on her phone, so she didn't answer it. But they left a voicemail, and I thought I would share it with you today.
Just some random voicemail from some random person.
Yeah, we've never heard of this person before, and after we listened to the voicemail, we're sure it was no one we knew, because it's pretty indecipherable. But I'm going to play it for you and see if you know what he's talking about. Here it comes. Okay. Here it comes.
Man, you open the trap house, I'm boy. Riding dirty over there, I'm boy. Yeah, holla, boy. Yeah, how are you struggling?
Well, he... Did you... I think he clearly wanted a call back.
Yeah, I got that. So maybe we should call him back and we can discuss whatever it is he wanted to discuss there.
When you wrote... You tried to transcribe it to me in text earlier.
Yes. And that
you did a good job of it, actually.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like a... way
It is, isn't it? That's exactly what it is. I don't know what his intent was. He may have been...
Man, you open the trap house, I'm boy.
Uh-huh.
Riding dirty over there, I'm boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, holla, boy.
All right. It's like a drunk Waluigi or something. I don't know how to describe
well,
it.
Well, thank you for that.
Now you can go to sleep.
Now I can go to sleep.
Man, you're gonna trip out, boy. Right there, you're gonna trip out, boy. Holla, holla, boy.